Welcome to Inside Education. This is episode number 365 of Inside Education on 103.2 Dublin City FM with me, Sean Delaney. Inside Education is a collection of weekly insights and ideas on all matters relating to teaching and learning. To download or listen to previous episodes of Inside Education, go to seandelaney.com and click on podcasts. This week on the programme, I'm delighted to bring you another interview that I recorded last month at the annual meeting of the American Educational Research Association in Toronto. Barbara Schneider is a sociologist and is the John A. Hanna University Distinguished Professor in the College of Education and the Department of Sociology at Michigan State University. She has authored 13 books and numerous articles on the social contexts of schools, families and work. We discuss topics like school transitions, access to college, and flow or optimal learning experiences. When we spoke, I first asked Professor Schneider how the disciplines of sociology and psychology intersect in her work. And she responded to this question by giving a detailed answer to the question and an overview of some of her research projects to date.
For teachers, it's important to recognize that sociology is a study of context. So that means the classroom and all the different parts of a classroom, how young people interface with one another, how instruction changes the nature of learning within a classroom, how a classroom is nested within a school, how teachers have different social relationships with other teachers in that school, how teachers relate to the authority in that school, how the authority relates to the teachers. So these are all of the kinds of things that really impinge on how a system, a school system, operates and functions. And that's what sociology is about. It's about the system. Now, when you go to psychology, that really talks about the person and what's inside the person. And where my work is at the nexus of the person in context. So I'm always looking at a person, their motivation, their interests, and how that is shaped by the context in which they find themselves, whether that's the family, whether that's the classroom or the community in which they live. And all of my work throughout my career has really focused on that. I have had three major efforts that I would talk about in that context. The other thing that is important with respect to sociology is that it has always been about equity. It's always been about equal educational opportunity, access, and social justice. So these are the thematics that drive very often the kinds of questions that people are interested in understanding, and they certainly have been mine. So one of the things that I have paid particular attention to is the development of adolescence in context. And one of the things that, of course, as a sociologist, I was deeply concerned about are the inequities that are so apparent when you look at different kinds of schools. And how does that come about? And what are the implications for individuals? That led me to, one, look at issues about private schools, charter schools, elementary schools. It led me to the work that I did with Tony Breich on trust in schools, because there, as sociologists, we both were interested in understanding key elements of social capital and what social capital was about. And through our readings and discussions and looking at our data, we realized that one part of the social capital paradigm that needed a lot more explanation was about these relationships that people formed in schools and how these relationships affected the equity and inequality that young people very often experienced in schools. So trust in schools is really one of the most important aspects of children's learning with respect to how teachers network with one another, how they network with parents, how they network with their administration. And there are several things in the trust in school work and relational trust that are extremely important for dealing with these questions of equity and access. The first has to do with when we built this model of relational trust, the reason we trust with each other when we're in schools is for the moral imperative of trying to do whatever we can for children. That has to be at the very key top of what it is that we think we're doing when we're there in schools. And not that I want to call it the bottom, but you start the process by respecting other people, listening to what they have to say, and then identifying people that have strategies and that walk the walk, walk the talk of the walk, and that's also a fundamental part of what this is really all about. But when you come right down to it, how we interact with each other in schools has to put at its top the personal welfare of the students that we're trying to take care of. Because I was always interested in issues related to what happens to young people when they leave school, and this was the work that I started to do in the 90s. My own dissertation very much was in elementary schools. It was really kind of a social capital storyline. So that work with Tony Bright kind of matched some very early thoughts that I had. The work that I did with adolescents really was work I did with Jim Coleman and Mahalia Csikszentmihalyi. And here we were really looking at what happens to young people as they transition from elementary school to high school. So for the work that Jim and I did, Jim Coleman and I did, had two major foci. One was looking at how different social contexts impact that transition from eighth grade into high school and the role of parents in that process. That had resulted in two major books, Parents, Children, and Schools, and then Redesigning American Education. And those redesigns of American education, I think, were very important at the time because they really put the focus on what the quality of education should really be about. Then in the middle 90s, we had a wonderful opportunity from the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to do a longitudinal study of how young people think about work. And that brought me in contact with Mahalia Csikszentmihalyi. And he's
best known for his book called Flow.
That is correct. And I learned all about how you found out about Flow. He had a pager method where you beeped young people randomly throughout the day and to see how they felt. And I thought, wow, if you could take that and put that in a school situation, we would actually know how kids feel when they're in school, when they're learning. And I absolutely found myself at the nexus between Jim and Mike as the, you know, really having a huge impact on my own thinking for the future. So we finished the book about young people. And when we finished that book, there were two books that came out of that work that I did with Csikszentmihalyi. The first was The Ambitious Generation with my colleague David Stevenson, who at the time was working in the U.S. Department of Education, and then Becoming Adult, How Children Think About the World of Work. And that was the second. That was the book I did with Csikszentmihalyi. It was an edited volume, but it really shouldn't be thought about as an edited volume, because all of the chapters in the book were the graduate students that were working on our project.
Could you say a little bit more about how you studied flow in the classroom and what led to the moments of flow for the students?
Okay, so we just took the regular flow model in the classroom, but it's the work I'm doing now that transformed that concept of flow into optimal learning moments, which is the model I'm using today, right now, to really think about learning in classrooms. So I'm going to take you out of that, although the most important part of the work that we did in the 90s led to the College Ambition Program, which is to help young people get into college. And I've been doing a lot of work on that continually. Most recently, I've developed an app, which is called In It to Win It. it's used on a phone, and it's for children to learn about what kind of education you need for different kinds of jobs, and you play it, and you get different points. And you can play it over and over again to find out, well, if I want to be a doctor, what should I do? If I want to be an astrophysicist, where should I go? And so the idea is to give them a chance to explore different kinds of careers by gaining points and getting a prize at the end, which is an internship in a program that they want to get more information about. So the work I'm doing right now, which I think, you know, is sort of the capstone, if you would call it that, of my career. I always have a partner, and I'm working with a brilliant science research educator, Joseph Krajicek, who has developed these fabulous science curriculums and assessments for both elementary and secondary school students, and all based on this concept of project-based learning, for which he started his career on, and he has a whole system for principles of project-based learning. So when he thinks about project-based learning in the context of the next generation of science standards and three-dimensional learning, he's not thinking about it as a project. It's not a project. It's about a system by which you foster certain kinds of things in classrooms to increase problem solving and figuring things out. So how does that relate to me? Well, first, I'm with all the experience I had with Tony and Jim and Mike and everyone, is that I am someone who really focuses very much on trying to understand what kind of questions we can ask, what kind of evidence we can collect, and then how rigorous is the work that we're doing, and can we really make claims that it works? So that's who I am, and that's what I'm about. And Joe and I worked together on this project, but in the course of that project, I realized that flow is a great way to think about what you would like to see kids do if they were in a situation in schools that had challenge and interest and skill to it, and then how would we think about those things and how they came together, and then what that would likely be related to. So I started thinking about this a lot in the context, too, of learning sciences and cognition that sort of exploded right now in neuroscience, because the challenge part of flow really, to me, needed more articulation in the context of the classroom, because that's where the neuroscience and learning science people have really come in, I think, quite strongly and quite right, that young people need something that kind of propels them into trying to take on something that they may not know the answer to, but they feel they have the skills, the requisite skills to be able to do it, and it's something that they're has meaning and purposefulness to their lives. So for me, the interest component of Csikszentmihalyi's model, which I absolutely, of course, has been the foundation of all of this work, is really something that you had an interest in, you know, because maybe you had a talent, you could play ball really well, or you could swim, or play the piano. But it was really in the context of school. We have people that have lots and lots of different talents, but you're trying to get them to learn something. So that's a very different way of thinking about interest in the context of education. So for me, and I think this is true for not so much the neuroscience cognitive people, but more the human development people, is that when you try and learn something, it has to have meaning and purpose to your life. You have to ask that question, well, why am I teaching this? What's the kind of questions that the students need to know to answer to be able to understand a phenomenon I'm trying to teach? How can I make that and put that in the context of their lives? So this is the beauty of why I really find Krajicek's work so helpful in this, because he's always turning the tables so that young people are the ones asking the questions, But the teacher raises this in the context of a phenomenon where she pulls or he pulls back and the students take over.
So if you were to talk about the kind of preparation then that a teacher needs to do to create these optimal learning moments, how can a teacher prepare for these moments?
Well, first of all, we believe this happens in situ. You could take an optimal learning moment, but you have to place it in a context of a series of tasks and learning experiences. It shouldn't just be a model that you kind of think about, well, if I do this, it's going to be fine. No, it has to be in the context of a bounded learning experience, because then the tasks and the assessments and everything else you're trying to do come and form a system of learning. Otherwise, it doesn't work. So then you have to ask yourself, okay, well, if that's the situation that you're looking at, how does a teacher learn how to do this? Well, let's take science, because that's the one that I'm working in right now, because that's the most important one, at least to me. I think that all kids eventually learn to read, and your skill at reading, and you learn to write, and you have certain numeracy skills. But science is something that we must teach, and we don't. Our world depends on it. Unless we can get a handle on how to deal with the environmental changes that are going around us, if we don't start to get a better understanding of other human beings and how they inhabit these our planet, that these are kind of the scientific literacy issues that we are facing as a global society, and we must get to that. So if we're going to get to that, we have to look at science, and kids don't like science, and a lot of times science is not taught, especially in the elementary school. And in the high school, they stop before they get to the things that are really interesting and exciting about how we can really make a difference in our world. So science, to me, is it's the great place to think about discovery, because scientists love discovery. So if you can get them interested, you're really going to have the best kind of teachers you can get to teach science. So in the context of science, how do we do it? One is we really believe seriously that professional development is actually critical in this process. And most of our teachers today are not young teachers that are coming into the profession. They're, you know, mid-level teachers that are there for a while. So the question of professional development has taken on a heightened importance that it's never had before. And no one's going to want to do professional development and go to school all the time when they have a busy life, and a lot of these people don't earn enough money, so they take on two jobs anyway. So how can we really build professional development so that it's supportive, encouraging, and goes on? And we have to have a hybrid model, and that's what we do. We do a lot with video. We do a lot with opportunities for kids, people to Zoom into one another, to talk to each other, so that we have team leaders that are people that have been through our professional development, have helped us in the creation of our units. They come and they form these professional communities. These professional communities are virtual. And then we, of course, have meetings where we're face-to-face, because it can't be all virtual, and we just don't have the time and the money and the resources to make it all person-to-person. And then when we have measures in our research design that allow us to look more carefully at how the lessons are being implemented. So when we can get into see how the lessons are being implemented, we can actually target certain things that we want to talk to teachers about, like, well, maybe we should put a little bit more of this into the lesson. Maybe it would work better if we did this. But we don't script the lessons. We want the teachers to adapt the lessons to their own personal style. We're not in here to evaluate anybody.
But you design the initial lessons.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. The lessons are there for you to use. It's just everybody has their own way of going about it. So we have something that's called the driving question. It brings the whole unit together. Some people like to use a driving question whereby they have, you know, the students do it as a discussion board that they go through the whole class all the time. Some other kinds of teachers, they have, you know, classes of 35 and 40 students. They like to break them up. But essentially, they don't lose that concept of the driving question ever, and that students are really asking the questions for the driving question, and that there's tons of discussion, collaboration around that. And, you know, we have different kinds of things. We have to change certain units because of safety reasons. We're doing chemistry and physics. Some of the schools are woefully inadequately prepared to teach science. And
is that in terms of equipment?
In terms of equipment and in terms of safety, you know, just things that they need to have. They don't have labs. They don't have sinks. It's criminal, really, to think about the disparity in the kinds of opportunity structures that are available to children in different environments. And we absolutely have to change that. And whether it's giving every child a computer, whether you're going to put a sink or you're going to make sure that, you know, there are safety precautions so that no one's going to get hurt or burned. But because you want them to do the experiments, you want them to be the scientists, you want them to have the glasses on and the lab coats, you want them to know what it means to get actively engaged in the process. And you can't do that if, you know, if there's nothing in the classroom. So that's been difficult. And we're, you know, thinking about what we can do about that.
How does a teacher recognize this optimal learning moment?
Well, this engineer at Google, whose name is Robert Evans, developed this system called Paco. And it works on a phone, and the kids get beeped on their phone, and they tell us how they're feeling. And we share this with the teachers about how they're feeling. So if they're in an optimal learning moment, everybody's very much engaged. And they're happy, and they're satisfied, and they're all working and collaborating with one another.
But they have to remember to beep the phone.
Well, you can also see kind of things because the phones are randomly programmed to go off at different times so that it's not the case, you know, so we have to be able to measure, you know, your affect when you're not in doing it as well as when your affect when you're deeply engaged in a science experiment. But the other thing is that you'll see boredom and disengagement and a lot of distraction and too much pressure and anxiety.
And does the phone not add to the distraction?
No, because one, it's a dog barking and it only barks a few times and it isn't very loud. And the kid, I mean, these are kids that their phones buzz all the time. I mean, you know, when we first introduced, I have to say that this has been, I feel like I'm in a very strange experience because when we first went to schools and said, we're going to use phones, oh, this is going to disrupt the kids and they all don't know how to, and now we're in 2019. And you going to tell me that the kids don't use their phones all the time? I mean, they use it all the time. They don't beep all the time, of course, and they vibrate on their hips. And so it's like, well, what do you mean it's disruptive? They've got the thing disrupting them all day long. And so, this one's very small. It's very short. It takes not even a minute and a half because they're, you know, they know immediately. It's the same kinds of questions all the time.
And when this barks, they take out their phone and they have to answer a question.
Yeah.
So what might the question be?
Well, it's not one question. It's a series of questions. And so it's like, who are you with? What are you doing? And then there's a check, you know, and we ask very specifically about science practices and things. And then in other classrooms, it's just not as specific to the things that we think are critical for science learning. And then it's a question about who you're with, and then are you doing what you wanted to because you wanted to, you had to, and that's like a volition item. And then the importance to yourself question is there, and that's a very important one. You know, was this important to you? Does, you know, is this important to your family, your own goals? So those, and they're very quick. And then the issues about, are you interested? How challenged did you feel? Did you feel you had the skill set to do this? And then there's what we call the affective things, like, were you proud? Were you satisfied? Did you feel like you were persisting in what you were doing? And so those, there's a whole set of those. And then it just, you know, so it takes not very long at all. After doing this for a very long period of time, the method police kind of argued, oh, it should be a 7 scale, it should be a 4 scale, it should be this. And now, after doing this for 25 years, I'm absolutely convinced on looking at the data, you end up collapsing the data anyway. You might as well have a 4-point scale where 1 and 2 mean one thing and 3 and 4 mean something else. And it just doesn't work out when you kind of have 7 for this and 5 for that, and it just, it really makes it way too complicated.
And what age are these students?
Our chemistry and physics students are anywhere from 16 to 18. We also, because the National Science Foundation funded us and they have this wonderful program, the Academy of Finland, and they're our colleagues. They're doing the same thing in Finland. And Jari Lavalone and Katerina Salmonello-Arno are our colleagues in Finland, and we have done this particular program, Crafting Engaging Science Environments, with them. And they have gotten their funding from the Academy of Finland, and we've gotten our funding from the National Science Foundation. And those two organizations are talking to each other. And in fact, we presented here at the American Education Research Association. And you could see, because, no, Finland isn't the U.S. and the U.S. isn't Finland. We're two very different places. So culturally, of course, there are differences. And we're not trying to do this as one country better than another. We're trying to share and understand each other's systems and how we can inform each other to make all of our systems better.
So there's one part of me thinking, wow, this is such an innovative way of using the cell phones or the mobile phones. But there's another part of me saying, but is it not contradictory to be interrupting a flow moment, because by its nature, it's meant to be flowing?
Well, first of all, remember, we're not talking about flow. We're talking about optimal learning moments. We're talking about doing something in school and learning something. And we're not talking about, and we give kids a certain period of, they don't have to do it right that minute. So if you're about to go on a stage to give a recital, you're not going to be on the, you know, in the middle of a Schubert and then like pressing on your phone. No, that's not the idea. You know, so they all know, you know, that they can ignore it, they can put it on vibrate. It's not that. So the issues really are that they're really, you know, it's to try and capture the experiences close to the very moment that you're feeling. And you can reflect pretty carefully in a minute or two or five on, well, yeah, I felt really, that was great. That was a good experience. I'd like to do that again.
And that was Professor Barbara Schneider from Michigan State University describing how students describe optimal learning experiences. I'll bring you more from my conversation with Barbara Schneider on next week's programme. You can listen back to this programme or to 364 others by going to seandelaney.com and clicking on podcasts. My book about teaching, Become the Primary Teacher Everyone Wants to Have, was published by Routledge and can be bought at online bookstores or ordered from your local library. Until the same time next week, goodbye from me, Sean Delaney. Thank you for listening.